Lay back. This is not good. Talking about somebody knocking their feet out from under them as they get up to speak. Yeah, let's just look at an annual yearbook we haven't looked at in 30 years, you know? My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here. Great host. Thank everybody on the committee that asked me. Don't take it out on them. It's one of those deals. Pete and Barb picked me up, and what a cool deal. I need to do as I always do when I speak. I need to give you kind of a little rundown, kind of let you know where I'm coming. I think it's kind of disrespectful for me to get up and speak and not do that, because a lot of you guys don't. Some of y'all know me. Some of y'all have heard my tapes and stuff around, and y'all know kind of what you're getting. And some of you have never heard me before, and it's a little I think it's abusive to not let you know what you're in for. I've been called abrasive. I've been called abusive, disrespectful. True. I don't know. There's nothing wrong with that. I am absolutely passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at the flyer after Pete contacted me and sent me a flyer, and I looked up here, but for the grace of God. And, I realize that some of the stuff I'm going to talk about tonight, some of you guys in this room are not going to agree with. And that's so okay. Jim last night in his talk, I think he made a great point. He says, last night we were hearing Jim's story, and tonight you're going to hear my story, and we just got to hear Bev's story. This is the way it works. You'll follow us, and my story may not be the same as your story. Y'all with us? There's people in here that are non-alcoholic and addict, could not possibly identify with some of the stuff that I've been through, and that's okay too. I understand it. It's just not personal with me. I am passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. I nearly died getting to this fellowship, and once I got to this fellowship, I spent 7 years in and out, relapsing, just dying, listening to the absolute crap coming out of people's mouths. And if some of y'all are sitting in this room and you believe that every meeting is wonderful and everything is, you've been there. I heard people all the time, I've just never been to a bad meeting. I said, you've just not been to the same meetings I've been going to. I don't know what to tell you. I believe that the big book is the message that we're supposed to carry. And I believe that the traditions that we just read, our fifth tradition, says I have a responsibility to carry that message. And so I'm going to share some of that. It's my story. It's my experience. But for the grace of God, I would have been dead. Folks, not dead. And I think if I came up here and told you any other story just so I wouldn't have to take the heat, I think it would be disrespectful to y'all. And so I'm going to jump in this and do the best I can. I realized, Pete and Barb took me by Devil's Tower. I've seen pictures of that forever since. My dad gave us a little book. I'm a little geology fiend, and I loved minerals all my life. We were out rock hunting before I could remember doing anything else, and Dad had got a book on there, and I just had that image of that long before the spaceships landed on the damn thing. It was a pretty fascinating thing, but to stand up there yesterday afternoon coming back from the airport and to walk around that thing, and I was telling him, I'm from Texas. I don't want to look uncool, it was very emotional at times, not to want to cry, not to want to, because you're seeing something and experiencing something for the first time, and it's like I was trying to explain to a buddy of mine in AA today, and I was talking to him on the phone this afternoon, and I was trying to explain that experience, but he's never been there. He doesn't. How can words explain that mountain, that formation? And if you're not an alcoholic and addict, and you've never wanted to take your own life, you may not understand my passion. Y'all with me? Okay. You'll see in this coat? All right. Barb and I did. We went to high school together. I just need to tell you right now, Barb was the nice girl, that everybody, she's the nice girl. And Chris was the evil boy. No, Pete, we didn't date. So get that out of your head. I was too busy drinking to date. And that's the way that one went. I was a town, driving through Gillette today and seeing it was a town back then, 30 years ago. Kerrville was a lot like Gillette. It was a very small town community and very... I just what do we do in the Saturday nights? We go out and drink. And Friday nights, and we go out and drink. And I remember the first time I drank alcohol, and it was the same as every. I've heard the old timers share it this morning wonderfully from the podium. And Jim last night, you know, I just, when I drank, I got okay inside. And I need to back up just a second and tell you, you know, I for the last 10 years, I've had the absolute privilege of working in a treatment center. I do clerical work for a treatment center. One of my jobs in this hospital, I run a little store and I do some other things, but one of my jobs there is to make sure that the patients, when they leave that treatment center, get connected to Grade AA, to get connected to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what we see is time and time again is that cats will come into my hospital and they'll spend a whole bunch of money and they'll come and believe that spending that money in 30 days is going to get them well, you know, I'm fixed, you know. We've all seen that. And the truth is that we give them a good start and we get them connected to some people out here that can circle up the wagons and show them how to live a sober life. And that's the way this thing works. Y'all down with that? And so I'm really passionate about making sure these patients get connected to the people who are actually doing the work. See, there's a lot of people in the... See, there's two things going on. There's the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all follow us. The Fellowship is what we've been doing a lot of here this weekend in visiting and hugging on one another and telling stories. And just it's just the camaraderie of it. It's a cool thing, you know. And then there's the thing called the program. And over the years, folks, the program has kind of gotten lost. You know, we've kind of walked away from the message that was supposed to be carried. Y'all follow us? The program... My book says is about the 12 steps. It's about a thing called a spiritual experience. See, and for years early on, if you'll read the archival material, nobody in early AA had any bones talking about God. They made no bones talking about the spiritual experience. They understood that we worked the steps in order to have a spiritual experience so that we could recover from alcoholism. And then the treatment centers got involved and therapists got involved, and the doctors with their antidepressants got involved, and everybody else in the dog got involved. And then what we got now was a very socially correct fellowship where you can take it or leave it alone, and everything's okay. And we got a lot of people sharing opinions. Well, if that's too much trouble, then don't worry about that old four step right now, buddy. Just wait till you get comfortable for a while, and then you can do it. You know, and it's like, yeah, about the time you take that 45 out of your glove compartment and shoot yourself, you can do it. It's like, see, guys, I have a thing called alcoholism. I'm not a hard drinker. Somebody this morning introduced himself, one of the first speakers, I forget who it was, one of the old-timers, and bless his heart, he introduced himself as a real alcoholic. By God, my name's Chris Raymer, and I'm a real alcoholic. I'm the real McCoy. I cannot not drink. Wasn't always like that. I could go through periods where I could stay sober for long periods of time. Early on in my drinking and drugging, it was one of those frustrating little careers in high school. I didn't stay drunk all through high school. Well, most of high school, but not a lot of high school. But I didn't go to school because I got in the way with the drinking. And I was a professional chef. I wanted to be a cook. And so I went to Houston, got in an apprenticeship program. And I would go through periods of time when I didn't drink a whole lot. And there was no drugs involved. But I would have periods where I would drink a lot. But what was the constant through all of this? I'd be working at a place and I'd be making a whole lot of money. And then this little thing inside called the spiritual malady. We don't talk about it much in meetings anymore. We don't, you know, it's just not real acceptable sometimes to talk about it. The spiritual malady, the spiritual sickness that the book talks about. Dr. Silkworth makes a great case for it in the doctor's opinion. He starts talking about being irritable, restless, and discontent. Can y'all get down with that? And I'm drinking and it's treating that irritable, restless, and discontent. And the depression and the boredom and the anxiety. And I'm feeling pretty good. That low self-esteem we hear so much about, you know, that these are symptoms of a spiritual condition. Folks, I'm not making this crap up. This is what the book says. Dig? And I go through periods of time, and everything's looking pretty good, you know? And I'm drinking a little bit, and I'm holding it all together, and I got a good job, and I'm making money, and things get lousy, and I start drinking too much. And I'd go through a period of time where I'd be a chef at a big hotel, and then 6 months later, I'd be eating out of dumpsters in Houston, Texas. And then I'd get the job back and the girl back and the house, and everything would be coming together. And I'd have it all together. And this internal condition would start eating my lunch again. And I would have to go back to the one thing that ever treated that internal condition. See, alcoholics and addicts alike in this one similar situation is that you got to treat this internal condition. See, I can leave the alcohol and drugs alone for long periods of time. You follow me? But you see, because I'm an alcoholic, I don't get better. I get worse. Jim made a great case for it last night when he was talking. 2 years sober, sitting in a house wanting to commit suicide. You're down with that? See, that's alcoholism. We want to focus on the drink and all the stupid stories and stuff that we do and all the drama out there while we're under the influence. But the sad, tragic thing about Alcoholics and Addicts is that when I put the plug in the jug, I don't get better. I get worse. You dig? See, and this is what we need to treat. This is what we need to treat. You got it okay? Everything okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
We just want to hear you in the back. Try and lift the mic.
How about that? Can you hear me all right? You'll hear it.
Okay.
I'll wake up here in a second. All right. Here's what the book says real quick on page 34. There's a great little passage in here that nobody bothered to show me for 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous because we didn't read the big book in Alcoholics Anonymous and the groups that I started to get sober up in. We were too busy trying to talk about my inner child. It says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Stop right there. We're going to assume, of course, that everybody that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous wants to stop, which is a joke, you know, because what a lot of the people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous want to do is get the dang blowtorch away from my butt a little bit so I can move around, you know, jockey, and then I'm going to start drinking again. I don't want to stop drinking. I just want you to shut up about it, you know. But there came a time, though, folks, that I really, really, really wanted to stop drinking. And I really, really needed to stop drinking. Here's what it says. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he's going to drink or not. Many of us thought we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. The utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. You down with that? Makes me weep reading it. See, that was me. I did apprenticeship stuff in Houston and got, again, pretty successful in my field. But the depression's kicking my butt. And I guess it was the early 70s, 75, 76. I guess I picked up my first phone book and called a therapist to try to deal with some of this depression that was going on in my life. Irritableness, restlessness. I just always felt like the other shoe was fixing to drop. And I didn't know what the anxiety, you know, today they call it anxiety disorder. You know, and I don't know. All I know is that they medicated it well. You know, the pills And I started making geographicals around the countryside. I left Houston and went to Austin, and then left Austin and went to Atlanta. Jim was talking last night about all the moves. I said, buddy, I can relate to this guy. You know, it's like we just move a lot, you know. And every time I go to Vernon, Texas, I go back to Dallas, I go back to Houston, I go back to Kerrville for a short period of time. Every place I went, guess who showed up? Me, you know, and it's like, and I'm still feeling uncomfortable, and I'm seeing a therapist the whole time, and I got to tell you point blank, I'm not making fun of therapy because I still see a therapist, and I'm a huge fan of therapy, but you know, the book says that I'm suffering from a problem called a spiritual malady that needs to be treated by a psychic change, like a spiritual experience. You down with that? And I'm trying to treat it with therapy. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just not going to work. You know, it's like. It's kind of like having diarrhea and standing in front of a mirror doing positive affirmations. You know, it's just like... You know, I do not have diarrhea. I do not have... You better be in the bathroom when you're saying that stuff, buddy, because it ain't going to change. I'm not a big fan of positive affirmations. All right, but here... And so I'm seeing these therapists, and we're talking endlessly about the stuff. Because, you see, everybody's got an idea of why Chris is drinking. You know, it's, I'm blind in one eye. I got hit in the eye with a rock when I was a kid. And so, and I, you know, that's something. I go to the therapist. We talk about that. We talk about mama. You got some mothers in here? I got to tell you. You guys are so maligned in this world. I mean, it's like everything, it's all root. It just all goes straight back to mom, you know. And they're all evil. We understand that, you know. And... We're going to talk nonstop about mama. When we finish mama, we're going to go to daddy. And then we're going to talk about my identical twin brother. And then we're going to talk about little sister. And we're going to talk about growing up in the hill country and that sheep. You know? It was just one. remember we talked a lot about Vietnam. You know, as this kid of the 60s and 70s, Vietnam was a huge issue. We talked a lot about Vietnam. I'd never been to Vietnam. But we're going to talk a lot about it, you know, because we're chasing threads here, guys, because there's something that's causing this anxiety. There's something causing this problem. We talked about the abuse, and there was never any. We talked a lot about being gay. We were laughing earlier. We talked a lot about my sexuality. And I'm not gay. I mean, but I wanted to be, you know, because if I was, then there'd be something traumatic going on in my life, and I could understand why the drinking and drugging, you know. It's unbelievable. And we're talking about this stuff nonstop, and it's not getting better. And I'm blaming you all know how we do. I'm blaming everybody. Well, it's that woman, you know. It's the job, you know, and I changed to another job. And it's, well, I need to get out of the restaurant business. I need to still sell food. And that didn't work, obviously, you know. And I got to get back into the restaurant. They got to get those barbecue restaurants, you know, and got to get the catering company. Got to get the, and it's like, you know how God does. You know, God says, you know, to take care of his kids, and he does. You know, it's like everything I ever wanted, I got. And it's like when I had it all, I'm sitting there like, well, what else is there? Oh, there's just too much. I'm too stressed. That's what it is. I need to retire and get back. Is what? If I could just get the brunette to go out with me. We could just get the blonde. You know, we could just get that redhead. If we could just get them all three at once. Sisters, I'm just making that up. I never did that. You don't get three women at one time looking like I do. I'm going to tell you something, guys. I don't care how much alcohol you got with you. It didn't happen. But I mean, I'm trying everything in the world to get well. I get periods of time again. I've got some dry time, and I'm just not doing well. And I was married to a nice lady up in North Texas, and we had a little domestic disturbance, and I always prided myself on the fact that I never hit a woman, and I shoved a few, but I never hit them, and it was just a nightmare. And I'm taking some drugs at this time, and I'm drinking like a fish, and I'm miserable in my job, and I'm not a happy camper. And the cops come, and they slam me into I went back in the next day, and that night, early morning, coming back in, I apologized. I begged her forgiveness, and I'll never forget it. Her name was Karen, and she's a sweetheart. She's in Al-Anon today, and in Houston, Texas. And bless her, just putting up with my crap. And I promised her I'd never do it again. And you know, I hear people all the time. If an alcoholic's mouth's moving, he's lying. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Don't come say that to me, because that is disrespectful. Because, you know, aside from the fact that I have alcoholism, which is a fatal illness that's going to kill me, I'm a pretty honest old boy. And there were times, buddy, when I told her that I was going to stop that night, that I meant it with every fiber in my body. I would never touch another drop. You know, guys, I didn't. You know, for 2 weeks, didn't touch another drop. And then had a couple of beers and came home and was not drunk. You see, my mind, what I heard my mind say was that I wouldn't get drunk anymore. What she heard me say was I wasn't going to drink anymore. You follow the fine line there? Very well. It wasn't fine enough for her, and she packed her stuff and left. And she, thank God, she's alive today because of it. It was nuts. But I ended up through MHMR and through a good therapist. She looked at my chart, and I'm taking every antidepressant known to man, and I've been in every kind of therapy group known to man, and every church known to man. I've been dipped, dunked, neutered, sprayed. And I've sat naked in teepees and I've, you know, sweat my butt off and had crystals. Well, never mind. And we did colonics for a while. I mean, anything to try to fix what's wrong with me. And ain't nothing working, right? And so she looked at my chart. She said, Chris, you've tried everything in the world. On the outside chance, do you think maybe you might be an alcoholic? Your father was an alcoholic. Genetically, you might have predisposition. You might want to check that out. And I went to my first AA meeting. Early 80s, my first AA meeting up in North Texas, Denton, Texas. And I walked into a meeting that looked more like a seance than an AA meeting. And I walked in and they said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, well, I don't know. I drink a little too much. Well, welcome. Just exactly what Bev was saying. You know, what we did over the years was stop qualifying drunks. We stopped talking to them and finding out what room they needed to be into. We stopped talking to them like the early days. They didn't let you come into a meeting and just start talking. They set you down and qualified you. Are you one of us? Do you need to be here? Are you willing to go to any length? They didn't do that for me. They said, welcome. Hot damn, that's good. They sat down, first thing out of their mouth, chairperson. Guys, I told this from a million podiums. Who's got the problem? Starting to meet. We read how it works, right? Got the big books out. Who's got the problem? I do. Everybody's got a problem. And so we spent the whole hour talking about this lady's problem. You with me? I'm going to lose some of you here. Oh, that's great. Next day, went to another meeting. Who's got the problem? Pick me. I got the problem. Talked about the guy's divorce. Now, guys, I'm walking out after every one of these meetings and getting drunk. You know, I got a quart of beer in the truck, and I can't get sober because I don't know how to get sober, and it's obvious I ain't going to learn how to get sober in the meetings I'm going to. You know what I'm going to learn how to do? I'm going to learn how to run my little life. And I spent 7 years. That's what y'all. I just come outside myself when I start talking about it. 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out. Meeting makers make it. Let me tell you something about meeting makers make it. Meeting makers stick around long enough till their internal condition drives them out to drink again. People that work the steps make it. And that's my experience. Meeting makers make it. I'm a meeting-making fool, buddy. And I'm going to meetings, you know? And we're going to talk about the war stories until the cows come home. And we're going to talk about the problems. Because, you know, after all, if you come into this meeting and you got a problem and you leave with the meeting, you're going to might drink. Unbelievable. Guys, my book said quite clearly that if I'm suffering from a spiritual malady, there's only one thing that's going to treat that. That's a spiritual experience. My book didn't say I was going to drink if my wife left. Or I was going to drink. Y'all need to understand. How many of y'all, let's play this in here tonight. How many of you cats in this room right now drank a drug when you had a lot of money in the bank? Raise your hand. How many when you drank when you had no money in the bank? Same hand. How many when you had a great job? Crappy job. Big Lincoln Town Car. Riding a bicycle. Here's the kicker. Come on now with it. Here's the kicker. How many of you guys was drinking and drugging when you had a wonderful woman to live with? You were with somebody that you really loved. How many when you was dating Satan's sister? Same hand. So what are we doing up here? If we're drinking and drugging, what? Guys, I drank because it was Tuesday. I drank because it was Wednesday. I drank because it was Thursday. I did not drink. I didn't have to have a bunch of catastrophe around me to give me an excuse to go drink. I drank because I needed to drink. You know, one day I'm drinking and everything's fun. It's fun when we first start. And then all of a sudden you wake up one day and you realize you look yourself in that bathroom window, you know, and you look at yourself in a mirror and say, you know, Chris, this stuff's getting out of hand. Now all of a sudden I'm drinking just to get okay inside. See? I don't want to get drunk. I don't want to get squashed. I started out as a kid doing that. In high school, we'd go out and see how drunk we could get and bark at the moon and puke and have a great time. You know, it was just fun. But you know, I'm a chef at this country club. I don't want to get drunk. I don't want to go into happy hour shit-faced. I want to go into happy hour cool. y'all understand that? I drink a couple of beers and I can talk and dance and everything's cool. It's when I drink 7 or 8 and I got my patch on crooked and I'm looking pretty. That's not good. That's not what I want. I'm drinking just so I can get up and go pay the bills and go to work and mow the lawn and take care of my life. Y'all down with that? But we're going to go to the meetings and we're going to talk about the problem of the day. You know? Believing that if I can fix that problem, this is where treatment centers have killed millions of us. Believing that if we can get all our little ducks in a row and everything's good out here, that we're going to stay sober. What kind of a crappy program is this that only works when things are good? Because I don't know about you guys, but I mean, if I don't do anything real stupid, you know, in about two, three more weeks, I'll have 16 years of sobriety. And I got to tell you, there's been some great days in those 16 years, and there's been some days, buddy, I'm going to tell you, I did not want to live. I did not have, I've been through a divorce in sobriety. My dad died in sobriety. I am not. Thank God this program is not about my circumstances. Thank God that the contingency of my sobriety has got nothing to do with my external world out there. God, what? That's the most freeing thing I can say from this podium tonight. If you're waiting for somebody out there to change so you can be okay in here, you have put a noose around your neck. Because of the grace of God, I can be free no matter what goes on. 1987, that wife has left. The third and fourth business has been bankrupted. And I'm working for my brother, my twin brother up in North Texas. We own a bookbindery up there. And he started it from nothing and turned it into a big concern. And thank God for family. Al-Anon, welcome. Thank so much that you were here. And my brother gave me a job because I couldn't work in the industry anymore. And I'm working back here in the warehouse. And drive home one night and... one night. It's 3 o'clock. Time for a drink. You know, dig? And I stop by, get a 12-pack of beer and go home and pick up a stack of return checks that thick. And, you know, I'm sitting in my little crappy apartment in Lewisville, Texas, and I'm unrolling those checks. And here it is. There's the rent check. There's the, you know, and it's like I bankrupted my checking account one more time. I'm 35 years old. I have a distended kidney damage and liver damage. I'm swollen. But I am malnutritious. Yeah, fix it for me, Beverly. There you go. Thank God you're here. I'm starving to death. I'm starving to death. I can't eat. I can't eat because I'm too afraid to go get food. Y'all follow what I'm saying? I'm taking about a handful of pills a day, just polar, manic depressive, lots of pills I'm taking to try to. I hate my life, and I made a decision that night, conscious decision to take my own life. I made it. I was never raised around that stuff, and I understand. I went to the bathroom without a whole heck of a lot of thought, and not a lot of drama, no big long notes. I said I can't do this anymore. And I drank another beer, and I went to the medicine cabinet, and I got some pills, and I ate the pills, and I drank the alcohol, and I laid down on the bed to die. I heard a voice that said, "Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA." I don't know what I heard. You know how that is? You drink it. I don't know if I heard a voice or not. The guy next door hammering nails, for all I know. I don't know. I heard a voice that said, "Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA." Now, I'm arguing with this voice, so I'm hearing something, you know. I'm saying something along the lines of, if I've got to go back to AA and listen to one more stupid war story, or listen to one more person talk about their bad day, I'm going to forget it. I'm not going back. "Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA." And something in me made me get up and make myself sick. And I was up half the night. I laid back down, got some sleep. The next morning I went up. I got a doctor to help me detox. And that night, went to an AA meeting at 6 o'clock. Walked in the back door. I didn't want anybody to know I was going to AA. You know, I mean, y'all follow what I'm saying? Everybody knows I'm drunk. Everybody knows I have a problem with alcohol. But I'm going to tiptoe in the back door because I don't want anybody to know that I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's the lowest echelon in the world. And I just like... And I walked in the back door, and it's just exactly what Bev was talking about. There were some people in that room. They were all carrying big books like this one. I knew the minute I walked in, I knew I'd screwed up royally. You know, I mean, I walked in. Of all the meetings I could go to, Dallas-Fort Worth area where we're from, you know, there's about 1,500 meetings a week, folks. Unfortunately, and there's only about 20 of those are literature-based meetings. Most of them are what we call open discussion meetings, which I absolutely hate. But literature-based meetings, I happened to walk into one where they were talking about God and the steps. Dig, and it's like I walked in and they were laughing and smoking cigarettes. One of those shotgun meetings when the ceiling was lowering down like this, and it's like, and I walked in and somebody hooked their finger in my belt loop, and I'm backing out because you're laughing and you smell good and you're pretty, and I just like, and I felt real self-conscious all of a sudden. It's like, it's like you think I was wearing a patch or something. I don't know. Everybody's looking at me. I don't know. But I hadn't bathed in days, and I was not a happy camper. And I started to back out because I thought I kind of overreacted here a little bit. I'm going to go home and have a couple of beers and think about it. And this little girl got hold of my belt loop and said, "Sit down, cowboy, you're not going anywhere." And they set me down. I'm talking about the power of God, because I mean, I was untouchable. And she set me down, and I'm just amazed that somebody's going to sit next to me. And she patted my little leg and cleaned up my spilled coffee through that meeting. They talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and they talked to me about working the steps. They went around the room and they shared miracles about... See, they didn't do a first step meeting where we're going to go around and tell our stupid war stories. I was in a meeting. I don't know why we do that to newcomers. They're in the stupid meeting, folks. Why are you going to tell them another war story? Do you think you're going to scare them into staying? It's probably the most controversial thing I say from the podium because everybody believes that's all we got. All we have is our story. You know, shame. If all I've got is my story, to heck with me. What about the literature? What about the 164 pages that shows me how to have a spiritual experience? Haven't I got that? Yeah, you better believe it. But we're not going to get a chance to talk about this because we're too busy trying to scare each other in here. That's why we can't keep the young adults in our meetings. Isn't that right? That's why we can't keep the young adults in our meetings. That's why we kill thousands of women every year. I mean, what if we're having this word called discernment, for heaven's sakes? I'm not talking about from the podium like this where we tell our war stories. I'm talking about an open discussion meeting, and you've got a businesswoman in there, beautiful, nice, tailored business suit. She's sitting in there, got a little purse there, and she's sitting there for the meeting. And then we got little hairy-legged guys in the room feel like they're absolute chosen duty to explain how many times they've been to prison and how many people they've chopped up and how many wives they've abused. And this poor little lady sitting there like this, you know, "But I think I'm in the wrong room, you know? I got to get..." Why do we do that? You know what they talked about that night with me in that room? They talked about getting their credit cards back. They talked about getting married. They talked about having dates. They talked about going to dances. They talked about doing things sober. At the end of the meeting, they came up to me after the meeting and said, the old timers got around me and that little girl that was sitting there and says, "Christy, are you ready to stay sober the rest of your life? Are you ready to go to any length to get sober?" I made some discussion about one day at a time, and they weren't interested in one day at a time. They'd seen me for 7 years up there picking up chips, folks. I understand what you're saying. They wanted to know from me if I was ready to make a commitment. After some discussion, I said yes. And they had somebody follow me home, and the next morning, that person was there on my doorstep to take me back to a Saturday morning meeting, where we did a literature-based meeting and read some more on page 17 about our common solution. Y'all with me? That afternoon, after a little Mexican plate at lunch, we went back up to the club and did a third-step prayer. And that afternoon, they gave me the information, a little notebook, to do a four-step. They showed me out of the book how to do a four-step. Guys, I'm 2 days detoxing, and I'm working on a four-step. I want to tell you something, because it was people just like Buddy that were there that loved me enough to tell me the truth. Nobody was trying to dust me. There was a lady that wrote this article in Box 459. It was years ago. I would love to meet this woman. And in this article this lady wrote, she said, "At what point does live and let live become apathy?" And I watch this in our meetings all day long. I watch this happen no matter where I'm traveling, no matter where. I watch this happen all day long. Newcomer comes in, he's uncomfortable, he's freaked out, and everybody just ignores him because everybody's tied up into their own little clique and nobody's got time to go help that newcomer understand. See, when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've got a little window. That was my experience. I had a little window to get sober. It's called God's grace, folks. It's not called a pink cloud, you disrespectful you-know-whats. It's called God's grace. And the obsession to use will usually leave a newcomer pretty quick on without much effort on his own part. And we got a little window to get him connected to this God to have a spiritual experience so that grace lasts, so it stays. You with us? But we got morons in this room telling people to take their time to work the steps. Show me in the book where it says that I'm supposed to take my time to work the steps. The book says I'm supposed to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Why does that always get translated into take your time to work the steps? I don't have time. I don't have time. Because if the depression returns, if the mental obsession returns, the desire to drink returns, I'm going to go drink. And no put the plug in the jug is going to work for me. Because I don't have a choice whether I'm going to drink or not. That's what the book says on page 24. If you can choose to stop and make it stick on your own power, you're not one of us. Well, I'm one of you. And those people saved my life. And they introduced me to people in the fellowship that I would remain friends with to this day. The Buddy Rosses. The Bill F's. Jan V. I could go on and name them just like y'all could name them. People that were there. They took time. Last night coming into this room, they had the little greeters at the door and they were dressed up, had a little tie on, you know, and they were greeting. And I watched Irwin walk in and he reached out his hand. The little guy shook his hand and says, "Welcome." And he said, "That's very important what you're doing. That you we have a greeter here to welcome the newcomer." And I'm right behind Irwin and I'm sitting there like, no shit. No, because he's slow. It would have been just as easy to blow by him. Thank you. Glad you're here. And come on in. He stopped for a minute with a newcomer to explain the importance of having a greeter. We think the newcomer is going to come to this fellowship and know everything there is to know. They don't know where the big books are. They don't even know where the bathroom is, for Christ's sake. And you expect them to know how to behave in a meeting. What to do. How are they going to find out if you don't teach them? We've got a short period of time that we can do that before they get so uncomfortable in their skin they can't stand it and leave. Had a friend of ours up in North Texas at about 5-6 years sobriety that shot himself Sunday. This man was sober 6 years. Was he sober? Let me ask you a question. Or was he dry? Because see, sober people don't shoot themselves. Dry people shoot themselves. Man had been around the fellowship for 6 years and had never worked the steps. Those are the kind of people I think about at night. Let me tell you something, folks. That weekend, they had me answering the phones at that group. They had me on a cleanup committee the next week, helping keep that club clean. They said, "Chris, you've been a taker all your life. It's time that you started giving back." And they gave me a job in Alcoholics Anonymous so I would stay. Hallelujah for them. Let me say a couple things and I'll let you guys out of here. At some point, friends, whether you're brand new in this room or whether you've been around for a long time, at a certain point in our sobriety, we have to stop running from something and start running towards something. Can y'all get down with this? It's like fear was not going to keep you sober very long. You can't spend your life running from the drink because the drink is not the problem. At a certain point, we need to get excited about what this program is about. This program is a way of living which allows us to walk free on this earth. And that's what those people did for me. I got a chance at 2 weeks into that period of my life. At 2 weeks after I tried to commit suicide, I've got a completed fourth step, ready to dump a fifth step with my sponsor. I'm already active in service work. They didn't just turn me loose. They're right there with me, showing me what to do. Y'all with me? And I drive home on a Friday night after an 8 o'clock meeting, and I'm sitting there, and I don't know what's come over me, you know? I'm singing with the radio, and guys, I don't sing, you know, dig what I'm saying? And it's like I'm all of a sudden I'm a little happy grasshopper, you know, and it's like it's feeling pretty good for a change. And I'm starting to see a little hope in my life. And I get out of the truck, and I'm thinking it's weird that something's going on with me. My your thoughts and attitudes will shift. And my thoughts and attitudes are shifting. Those people that I would have shot 2 weeks before if I'd had a gun because they were laughing too loud, you know what I'm saying? They were irritating me. I would have taken a bullet for any one of them 2 weeks later. That's because I'm, for the first time in 7 years in the fellowship, actively participating in my own recovery, taking some action on my own behalf to get connected to this thing called God. I pulled down the tailgate of that old beat-up pickup truck and set it on the... It was one of those cold November nights up in Dallas. Not cold like here. Let me just tell you that. I know. But cold, you know? And I pulled it down like that, but there's not a breath of air. Just unbelievable. And I sat down on that tailgate, and I look around, and there's a 7-Eleven over here, and a Stop and Go over here, and a Circle K. There's little convenience stores with beer, right? There's a bar that I've got a tab in right across the street. My other issue dealer lives in the apartment complex where I live, and it's Friday night, and I got a pocket full of money, and there ain't nobody in my house but two stinky ferrets. Y'all follow us? Y'all had rats, I had ferrets. You know, and it's don't even ask. We're not even going to go there. And I can tell you, those ferrets didn't care if I came home drunk or not. Y'all follow me? Here's the difference. Guys, here's the difference. I'm sitting there and I realized suddenly, it was an epiphany for me, that for the first time in my adult life, I didn't want to drink. Nobody was going to stop me from drinking. The desire to drink was lifted from me. I had been placed, like the 10-step promise had said, in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I didn't have to avoid alcohol or drugs anymore. I was walking on different ground. Everything shifted. They said, Chris, all the steps, my brother says this from the podium all the time, it's the best thing he says, all the steps get us ready to do the 12th step, which is giving back, helping the other alcoholic and addict. You see, guys, they're coming. Y'all think that the treatment centers are going to come up with some great idea to fix us. You know, I mean, I hear everybody giving the bad rap to treatment centers until I want to puke, you know. That you think the doctors are going to come up with an anti, you know, alcohol drug, the pill. They've got 1,000 anti-craving drugs out there right now, and none of them work. It's like I want an anti-obsession drug so I don't think about it. You see? Y'all wait for somebody else out there to fix the problem. Guys, 68 years ago, we got the solution. It works great. There were areas of this country in the early 30s, 40s, that had almost 100% success rate. Everybody that worked the steps got sober. And right now in the United States, our success rate still hovers around 20%. Best case scenario. Very few people are getting well. Why? Because we stopped with the fifth tradition where it said that my primary purpose is to help others get well. We're just looking over for somebody else. Well, I'm brand new. You go help them. No, I'm busy on this other committee. I'm kind of overloaded. You go help them. Well, let's just all stand around and point at everybody else while the guy comes in, turns around, and walks right back out again. You think I'm speaking from some spiritual mountaintop up here saying that I didn't do that? You think I've never gone into a meeting and monologued forever about some crappy problem of mine? I have. Do you think I've ever turned my back on a newcomer because I wanted to go home and watch a ball game? I have. I'm just saying, just because we do it, then don't make it right. You'll follow us? Let me run something else by you before I let you out of here. Guys, I believe we've all been given a responsibility. God's grace is even and it falls evenly on everybody. I was taken from the pit, but I have a responsibility to turn around and help the other guy out of the same pit. Whether it's convenient or not. This is not a disease of convenience. You see, one of the things I see a lot of us do in our recovering life, I'll say this and be quiet. Who the hell is that? I watch a lot of people come into the fellowship like Roman candles, just like I did, and they get to a certain point, and they got a few years under their belt, and they get complacent, and they get flat. You know, I'm bored with AA. You know, I'm tired of this time, and it's like I need to ask you if you were actually out there working with others. Sitting across the table like Jim was talking about last night, going through the big book with them page by page, showing them how they can have a spiritual experience. I mean, you can't read from page 23 to 43 about the mental obsession with a newcomer and not watch the light come on in their eye and not walk out of that room higher than you've ever been in your life. There's nothing more addictive than that, watching somebody change right before your eye. And it was God's grace that did it, but it was the power through you that allowed it to take place. See, God's my job is to plow the stupid field, folks. God's going to make the plants grow. The problem is we don't have enough people planting out there. No, we you know what we need in this fellowship now is we need more spiritual mentors. We need more teachers out there in the trenches, going to jitter joints, going to the detox centers, going to the halfway houses, making sure these people have got a clear message of hope, Because isn't that what we're selling? Isn't that what this is about? Sharing our hope with a newcomer? We need a few more spiritual mentors and a few less junior therapists in our meetings. That's what we need. The therapists do a great job with the therapy folks. Let's get them connected to a good therapist if they need that. But let's don't try to practice this stuff if we don't have the training to do it. What I've been trained to do, my experience shows me is that I know how to get out of that pit. I know how to get sober. I know how to stay sober. It drives me crazy when I go to these meetings and people say, they get up and pick up a 30-year chip. And, well, I don't know how. What kind of crap is that? Of course we know how it works. Of course we know how it works. Let's share it, guys. We work the steps so that we can have a spiritual experience. Nobody will disagree with this point, that we work the steps so that we can know God's will. Would you all agree with that? You see, because when you know God's will in your life, see, things start turning around. That God's will show you who to be with and who not to be with. What job to have and what job to get away from. You with us? It'll help your health. It'll help your finances. All this stuff. When my will and God's will are in alignment, life is a pretty cool place to be. Y'all agree with that? Some of y'all have been there. You got a big shitty grin on your face. You know, like, yeah, I'm down with it. Here's the problem that I see a lot of us in the fellowship. We get caught in that hard spot, that rock in the hard spot between knowing God's will, because we work the steps we know. You with me? You watching? And doing it. Because, folks, let me tell you, knowing God's will is half the... God's going to give you the marching orders, then are you going to have the courage to do what God is asking you to do? I just scalded a few of you in this room. It scalded me when I heard it. When I got called on the carpet. Because I was telling people that I knew God's will, that I was miserable in a marriage, and I hated my job. And somebody came and said, Chris, you continue to call yourself a believer, a Christian, and you believe you know God's will, and yet you've got all this dishonesty in your life. I would call you an agnostic. I said it. I hated that man. I did. I hated him. And I was forced to take some action on my own behalf. At about 14 years sober, I had to start the ball rolling to make some changes in my life. To start being the kind of person that I was sharing from the podium. My outside's got to match my inside. Was it hard to do? Toughest thing I ever did. Do you know I got through it with some grace and some dignity. And now today in my life, I've got an absolutely wonderful existence. Truly. Just got married about a month ago. Except the Yankees are losing. And when I go home, Sister Maurice is going to be a bloodbath at my house. You know? I may have to move up here to Wyoming. Because it's not going to be pretty at my house when I get home. If that's the kind of stuff I got to worry about today, I'm blessed. I am blessed. I'm going to tell you something. I love every one of you. I got a bunch of cards up here. It's got my number, my home number on there. I've got my email address. Any of you cats that are walking around this countryside up here in Wyoming freezing your little butts off, you little big book thumpers especially is who I'm talking to, if you're catching some flack out there and you're being made fun of because you're carrying a message of hope or you got a meeting going down the toilet and you take some responsibility and say, no, we're not going to talk about the babysitter again. We're going to talk about God and the power. Y'all follow me? And you're going to take some flack for that. When you stand for God, you're going to take some heat. You start taking that heat. I want you to pick up that phone and I want you to call me on that 800 number so that we can visit and be buds. Because you've got to know something, buddy. There's a bunch of us out there. I speak all over this country. I speak in other countries. I'm going to tell you something. There's a lot of us out there carrying the message of hope to the newcomer. I am so blessed to know every one of you. Thank you very much.